Good morning. We'll call the meeting of the Environmental Natural Resources Policy and Finance Committee to order. I'd like to start out with the approval of the minutes. Any discussion on the minutes? I do notice that the comments between Representative Uglem and Fisher are not included in here, but we'll overlook that. With that, Representative Fisher, would you move the minutes, please?
I'd be happy to move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion is approved. Then, just a little housekeeping here this morning. I want to say thank you to, we've got the Denny Pot back, okay? Representative McNamara, former chair, had that in his possession, and I'm sure he's watching this morning or listening in. And Amy was able to corral him and get the coffee pot for committee, so we have that. We had a few requests yesterday afterwards. And then I want to give a little shout-out to Emily's Bakery in Hastings, downtown Hastings. The treats over there for you are compliments of former Chair McNamara and Emily's Bakery. So thank you. We're going to start out today. Any quick questions from anyone first before we get started with MPCA's overview? That's very good. All right. So with that, Commissioner John Linkstein, please identify yourself for the record and have at it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
My name is John Linkstein. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and have been so since May of 2012. My middle name is my middle name. Link is what my mother wanted to call me. In central Illinois, where they grew up, people went by their middle name all the time. So when they moved to Minnesota for State Farm Insurance, where my dad worked for 41 years, I was called Link all the time when I was going to grade school. And in my family, my wife calls me Link. My sister calls me Link. So I use my middle name only because a whole chunk of my people in my life recognize me as Link. John was the only thing they recognized at the great University of Minnesota because they don't go by middle names at the U of M. So I had to learn to go by either name. So don't worry about my middle name when you address me. I answer to either, but I just always feel like I should explain that because people are confused sometimes about the three names. So, Mr. Chair, with that, we are eager today to provide an overview of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Our job is a very complicated one. I'm sure everyone who sits in a commissioner's job learns that over time, how complex their mission is. Ours is to protect air, land, and water, restore it, and improve it for human health purposes. We can't do that alone. It takes a variety of programs and assistance as well as support from communities around the state. I want to start off today with a story about a dairy, about our work with the dairy industry. And the picture you're looking at on this slide is of the East Dublin Dairy near Murdoch in Swift County. It's one of the largest operated dairies in the state. It's recognized for its progressive practices in herd husbandry as well as the health of their milk supply. Interestingly, I was at a meeting where Ecolab's Chief Executive Officer Doug Baker mentioned that the dairy industry in California is dying and will be dead soon because of the lack of available fresh, clean water. And part of the reason I bring that up, Mr. Chair, is because without adequate water, without reliable water, the dairy industry in this country cannot grow and cannot thrive. And in fact, experts in the industry say that the Midwest is where dairy is going to grow again. And so one of our largest dairy operators, the owner of this dairy, as a matter of fact, mentioned to me that they actually appreciated working with the MPCA because getting a permit from MPCA was difficult, rigorous, but transparent. And once they had their permit, they knew they had a permission to operate in an effective way for a long period of time with very light touch from the agency in terms of inspections and reporting and monitoring. So we have had a great deal of community support among the dairy industry for our feedlot permitting. We have some of the largest and expansive dairy operations in the state permitted under our state permits, and we are eager to see that grow. But it's also representative of one of the challenges that we face. Having clean water is one of our natural assets in this state. 60% of our water resources are not impaired, meaning they meet all water quality standards. They are available and ready to be used for beneficial purposes. 40% of our waters are not. We're in a good position, economically speaking, to make use of our water resources, and we consider them assets. Dirty water is a liability for our business community, and so we're interested in working with businesses around the state. So I want to move on and talk about our agency and give you this overview. We began as an agency 50 years ago this year. We were formed in 1967 by an act of the Minnesota Legislature, signed into law by the governor. I'll tell you a little bit more about that story later, about how we came to exist. But our mission, as I said earlier, is to protect and improve the environment and enhance human health. And enhancing human health requires a great deal of balancing. We do that through a variety of programs related to air, land, and water. 21 programs organized in 7 divisions, about a $400 million biennial budget, and we have almost no general fund. We have about 900 employees, and you can see on this slide and in the slides in your packet, we are located all across the state of Minnesota. We have about 650 employees here in the St. Paul office, and the remainder outstate in offices at Duluth, Rochester, Brainerd, Detroit, Flakes, Mankato, and Wilmer. We have Marshall too. We actually share offices at Marshall with county staff, and also our offices from Wilmer and Marshall cooperate with each other. Having our staff distributed around the state helps us to be effective and efficient in meeting the needs of our customers. And as you can see on the slide, 70% of our staff come from scientific backgrounds: engineering, chemistry, biology. Myself, soil scientist and hydrologist, that's my background, and a variety of other specific scientific backgrounds. We do that to generate expertise around our data, around the science and the data that we use. We also have about 2,000 citizens who volunteer to help us gather data about our environment. So data about our environment, about our health, that's one of our primary assets, and it helps everyone know whether we're getting our job done. Where does our money come from? As I said, we're gonna come through this very quickly. It's about a $400 million biennial budget. You can see the sources of revenue: the Environmental Fund, the Remediation Fund, Clean Water Fund. Very little, as I said, about 4% from the general fund. I'm not going to go into a specific set of details, Mr. Chair, because I know we're coming back to go very deep into our budget, and we're eager to do that with you. Our next, where the money goes, you can see here, this is a description of how we spend the money, what it helps us benefit. For the most part, the money is directly tied to our mission of protecting, restoring the environment, and enhancing health. Air, land, and water, and you can see those categories of how we use those resources, and that is, again, something we'll come back to in future conversations. We are organized in 7 divisions. We have staff in each of these divisions with a division director. Our staff are not siloed, and this is actually responding to a legislative auditor's report in 2002 that recommended that we work in a different way to be more effective and efficient in how we do our permitting operations, for example. We have staff that work across our agency to meet specific customer needs. So as you look at this org chart, you'll see there are municipal customers, industrial customers, and a variety of others that we work with. We do this with our permits, for example. There are about 18,000 permits that the agency has in operation at any one time. And a permit from the PCA is a little different than a permit you would think of going to the city hall to build a garage. A permit from the PCA is almost more akin to an agreement that you operate your facility or your business or your wastewater treatment plant or your site for development of homes or for sediment and erosion control. It's an agreement to protect the water, land, and air. So we do that work by having our staff work across so that, on an industrial facility, we'll talk about Cloquet, a business in Cloquet a little later, Sappy Industries, where our industrial staff work on water permits, air permits, and solid waste permits. Those are generally a team of people, but they're working on one facility, and they collaborate to make sure that the permit work that we do for one facility does not cause any hiccups in their operation, and they can comply with all the requirements for air, land, and water quality. Our core services and programs and products, I mentioned one, which is permitting. And when I speak to people more often nowadays, I'm challenged because of fewer and fewer people knowing how things are done in the world, where things come from, and where they go. And I talk about a place called Away. I ask kids all the time when I speak in schools, when you flush the toilet or when the garbage leaves the end of your driveway, where does it go? Their answer is almost always Away. Then I ask them to say, well, where is that place? Where do you think that place exists? Away. And often they stop there because they're not sure. So we talk to them about what wastewater treatment plants do, how wastewater treatment plants take the sewage that comes from our homes, from our communities, and treats it to a level that it can be safely put into our rivers and our lakes, safely placed there to cause no human health effects, no adverse consequences on our biology or ecology. We also talk about trash like that, too. Unfortunately, we have a trash problem. We don't have as much. For years, I talked about the problem that we have, which is a landfilling problem. We fill up holes in the ground with our garbage, with our waste products, and we've learned after decades that those places can create problems in our groundwater if we don't manage them very actively at the beginning. So our job is to actually reduce the amount of waste that we put into landfills. Some of it's incinerated. Some of it is the best use of our waste is to not landfill it or incinerate it at all, but find a way to put it back into the commerce of our state, reuse it as useful material for other materials. And like I said, with garbage, we are managing a legacy of pollution in this state. A significant amount of our work is to deal with past generations' decisions. They made decisions based on what they understood at the time. We manage over 110 closed landfills that were former dumps, community landfills. Some of them were, and they're all over the state. They're in every county and all kinds of communities. They are decomposing. They are releasing methane, which we manage to make sure that there's not harm to the environment. We also make sure that those places are cared for in the long run by monitoring the groundwater around them. So that's one example of a way that we manage that place called Away. Another is our work on the St. Louis River estuary in Duluth, where we are working to restore pollution that occurred from the late 1800s through the mid-1970s with discharges directly into the river for industry and industrial purposes. We are now removing contaminated sediments, cleaning up the river environment, working to make sure that we have a healthy aquatic ecosystem there. That work will cost hundreds of millions of dollars. A reason I bring that up is the best way to deal with pollution is the first way to deal with pollution, which is prevent it. Never let it happen in the first place. There's a second way to deal with pollution, which is to manage it or to deal with it as a source of cleaning it up. The third is, just like our health, go to the doctor and spend a lot of money for treatment. Treatment is the most expensive and difficult pollution solution. Mr. Chair, I've got three short videos I'd like to show. They'll take about 90 seconds. and we'll go through them. They provide just some quick examples of the work we do, and I'm going to have the staff just run through those for you.
Clean air means a healthier environment for people and animals to work, live, and play in. Minnesota has some of the cleanest air in the nation. Over the past 20 years, we've decreased the amount of toxins and other harmful pollutants in our air. We do this by regulating sources like factories and power plants and spreading awareness about non-regulated sources like cars, trucks, and residential wood burning. We give business owners and citizens the tools they need to make more environmentally sound decisions, and we monitor the air and alert the public when air pollution exceeds healthy levels. Minnesota's water supports a variety of uses like recreation, drinking water, and agriculture. It also supports a diversity of aquatic wildlife. Our lakes and rivers are a big part of our culture and economy. We look at fish and bugs to identify stressors like excess nutrients and sediment. We also monitor the pollutants that flow with water through drainage tiles and ditches, wastewater pipes, and agricultural runoff. We help to promote innovative techniques like buffers along streams, controlled drainage, and rain gardens to keep pollution out of our water. Hazardous waste can be liquids, solids, gases, or sludges. All require special handling, storage, and disposal. Improperly managed waste has led to a number of contaminated sites around Minnesota. Our Superfund program creates cleanup plans for abandoned or uncontrolled hazardous waste sites that pose risks to people or the environment. We work to clean up the contamination along with leaking petroleum storage tanks and closed landfills. Our goal is to make the land safe and usable again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to mention that in your packets you have sort of some synopsis of those stories so that you can refer to them if you want to ask us questions or come back to those in the future. We also have videos on our website that go into greater depth and detail that we can also help you navigate it as we visit further. So we are now on slide number 10, and I wanted to just mention that the laws that we're responsible for enforcing are those that come from the federal government and the state legislature. Many times states enact laws to empower programs to be implemented, national programs to be implemented at the state level. We've been doing this since the 1970s, and these are three of the examples of the federal laws that help us do our job, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and the Superfund Law. On this slide, you're going to see a picture of Beijing in October. They recently had another event, an episode like this, about last week, 4 days in which no vehicles were allowed to move around the city. Fortunately, we do not have that condition here in Minnesota, and we didn't come to clean air by accident. We worked diligently to improve emissions from our factories, from our power plants, and sources of fuels that have been used, and emissions that come from those facilities have been cleaned up. Also, our standards for vehicle emissions at a federal level have helped improve our air quality. We're glad that our air is consistently better than that. We also have state laws that we implement that you can see on this slide that get into the our air programs, our water programs, and our land programs. There are 229 of them in total that apply to our agency. The photograph you're looking at on this slide is of an event that led to the formation of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. There were two tank spills in the early 60s, one that occurred in North Mankato from Honeymead, which was a soybean oil storage facility. Those tanks that they had their oil stored in ruptured, leading to a catastrophic slug of soybean oil flowing down the Minnesota River into the Mississippi River in St. Paul. That first spill happened in 1963. It led to a massive fish kill because when there's oil in the river, all the bugs work to consume it. That reduces oxygen, and once the oxygen is gone, all the fish die. And so that's what happened. And the other tank failure that resulted in the massive kill-off of ducks in the Mississippi River in St. Paul was from an oil storage facility in Savage, Minnesota. The oil spilled into the river because the tank failed. That oil flowed downstream, coating all the ducks' wings, and they died. And one of the property owners and people who cared about the river in St. Paul invited Governor Rollvag to see what had happened and brought a bushel basket of dead ducks to the rotunda of the Capitol to illustrate his point that we must have a better way of controlling the risks of pollution to our environment. And that led to the formation in 1967 of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Prior to that, there was a Water Pollution Control Board and a number of other entities that existed to deal with sewer construction and maintenance around the state, but this was the first time that the agency was put together to address water, air, and land. And that's what we've then worked together with many partners to implement. We work with business owners around the state. As I said, permits from our agency are an agreement to operate. And I want to talk briefly about our work with SAPI, a paper company, a fine paper company in Cloquet, Minnesota. And we work with these industries to help them find the best ways to protect the environment and meet their business interests. With help from us, and this is a photograph I should mention, of a gentleman who is, I don't know if I can find his name, excuse me, Rob Schilling. He's the environmental manager at Cloquet's SAPI fine paper industry. We provided assistance to them, technical assistance and financial assistance, to help them reduce emissions from several sulfide compounds that they use in making paper and that are byproducts of making paper. What happened is that resulted in better odor control. Those of you who have lived in a community where there's a paper plant know that there's smells, odors that work around you. Because of the way they were able to change their systems, they reduced odors in the community. They also had a better treatment of methanol, which is a byproduct of their paper-making process. And the work that we were able to do with SAPI resulted in them saving $225,000 a year in operations. Another example of what we do is working with our citizens who monitor our streams. And this is another photograph of our citizen volunteer program where we teach people how to gather samples and how to analyze information to provide it to us so that we can get even more coverage of our state's water resources through monitoring. Lastly, I just want to talk about another example of foundry sand. Foundry sand was from St. Cloud. We had a business there that came to me and said, we are taking, as an industry statewide in our foundries, 80,000 tons of used foundry sand every year. Sand is used in a foundry to form the materials that they make. And once they used it, it has high concentrations of metals and other contaminants. The industry came to me and said, we think there's a better way to handle this material. We think we could reuse it. If we could treat it a little bit, get some of the metal out of it, then we could put it to a better use rather than just putting it into a landfill. We agreed that that was a good idea. We modified our rules. We modified our beneficial use guidelines for the foundry sand industry, so they now have a viable product that they can market to others for road construction, for other industrial purposes. And it was a successful story, and those 80,000 tons of sand are no longer going into a landfill. They're going back into industrial and construction purposes. That's our job. We view our job as avoiding waste, reducing waste, and improving the environment. And we consistently see that Minnesotans and business owners want to do the right thing. We often need to provide them with technical assistance, and we do that. We have staff in our agency that work with small business owners. We provide grants and assistance to small business owners and to others who need support for making changes in their operations to help air, land, and water. Last, I want to talk about our precious water resources. This is a photograph of most anybody's family, dog, a yellow lab. My brother-in-law had one, and this is not my brother-in-law's dog, but I've seen that dog do that a number of times, chasing the decoy. Jumping off the dock into a great, great-looking water resource. Unfortunately, the picture on the right also exists in our state. Green algae, harmful algae in our lakes and our beach areas. The actual picture you're seeing there is from Lake Bilsby in Dakota County and Goodhue County. Fortunately, the lake no longer looks like that because of work that was done to improve wastewater discharges upstream at Cannon Falls, Owatonna, and Faribault. By reducing their discharge of phosphorus and nutrients to the river, 70% of the nutrients that were entering Lake Bilsby have been eliminated. The lake no longer has harmful algal blooms like that, and it's a much better resource for recreation. Our purpose in doing our work on water is to have fishable waters, swimmable waters, and drinkable waters. Those are words directly out of the federal law: fishable, swimmable, drinkable. We do our work over the long term, and we have made dramatic improvements in our water resources around the state. As I said earlier, 60% of our water resources are unimpaired. That's a great achievement for a state as large as Minnesota. Many states do not enjoy that that clean water asset. The 40% of our water resources that are impaired need attention, and Governor Dayton has proposed several things in his term, but this year in particular, his bonding bill includes $167 million for municipal governments to invest in their wastewater treatment plants to improve water quality. We have been around the state as commissioners, myself, Commissioner Ellinger from the Health Department, to talk to communities about their needs, and what we learned in those conversations is that communities are facing an enormous challenge of aging infrastructure, population declines, debt load challenges, and the job of our agency is to support and assist them in meeting their water quality objectives so that they can say that they're doing their fair share of improving water quality, providing greater certainty for them that if they do their job, they will have the lightest touch from our agency from a regulatory perspective. And so, Mr. Chair, with that, I'd just like to wrap up and say thank you for this opportunity to be here, and I'm very happy to stay this morning and answer as many questions as you're willing to ask.
Thank you, Commissioner. Let's start with regulatory certainty. Last year I worked with the agency to get the bill passed and signed on regulatory certainty, and I think that was a good step. One of the questions I had at the time was, you know, it's fine that we're doing that here in Minnesota, but if we don't get the same type of regulatory certainty from the feds, our law may be overruled. So can you give me any details on, and I asked for this during the debate on the bill and leading up to final passage and the governor's signature, can you give me any details on conversations that you've had either with EPA or our congressional delegation in Washington, D.C., to see if they've been able to make any progress with EPA on regulatory certainty from the feds? And just for a point of information for members that probably are not familiar with regulatory certainty, if you could kind of walk through that, what that actually created for not just our business community, but also for cities and counties that have permits and whatnot. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm happy to. Regulatory certainty was our permits for water quality are issued under the authority of the Federal Clean Water Act and under state law. So the permit certainty, the regulatory certainty that's being described is, if a community installs the best available treatment technology to remove nutrients from their wastewater discharges, meaning they are doing the best, most current and up-to-date approach to reducing nutrient pollution, that they will be guaranteed that our standards will not change until the life of that equipment expires. Now, that was something that we felt was directly responsive to the challenge that communities are facing with increasing costs of operations and their debt service. So the regulatory certainty bill that passed last year, Mr. Chair, you're right, that was we felt very good about that. The permits that we issue are issued under the authority of the Clean Water Act, and the EPA oversees every permit that we issue. So when we issue a permit, the EPA has the opportunity to object or overrule a permit. They have not given us any indication that they would overrule or object to those permits that we will issue under regulatory certainty. I also work with all my colleagues in other states to advocate before EPA for regulatory efficiency and measures that will improve the ability of communities to meet their wastewater treatment needs. This is one thing that we've talked to EPA about. I've not gotten a specific answer from EPA about whether they would categorically guarantee approval of every permit, which I know they would very unlikely ever, if ever, do. But they are very aware of our work. One of the benefits that we have in Minnesota is we're issuing permits with a significant amount of knowledge about the water resources that we have. Because of the Clean Water Fund and the investments that we've made in understanding our watersheds, we have more data about our watersheds and our water resources and the discharges than almost anywhere in the country. Ohio has a significant amount of data on their watersheds as well, and a handful of other states. But part of our story to EPA is when we have all that information, when we know all this detail about how our watersheds are performing, and we can with great accuracy describe who's contributing what, we should be able to have greater flexibility in meeting the overall water quality needs of those watersheds. That's, I think, our best argument, is that we have the facts and the information, reliable and credible science, to persuade EPA that our permits are going to be reasonable. I hope, and we've gotten a number of communities that are interested in pursuing that regulatory certainty provision, Mr. Chair. We've got, I think, about 10 communities around the state that are eager to implement that. So that's one of the things that we should look to do more of. And I know you may hear over the months ahead from my colleague, Commissioner Dave Fredrickson, about agricultural water quality certainty, which is, again, doing the right thing on the land for agriculture to protect water quality, and if those practices are put in place and maintained, the property owner has regulatory certainty from our agency for a 10-year period that we will not impose any additional restrictions on their operation. That works for dairy farmers around the state because they apply manure and they use best management practices to protect water quality. So those are a couple examples of regulatory certainty, Mr. Chair, that I think are positive. The federal EPA still, as you know, forming up its new team. We will take this issue up with them when they're up and running.
Thank you. Just one real quick follow-up. And the other part of my question was, what conversations have you had with maybe our congressional delegation to see if they are interested in advancing that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for forgetting that. We've spoken with our congressional members in the Senate and the House. In particular, we've spoken with Representative Walz because of his long history and this area of agriculture and water, but we've also had some meetings around the state where we've listened to community wastewater treatment plant operators, and the members of Congress staff have been present for those, so we've explained this to them. We've not asked or heard anything about any federal law that would guarantee regulatory certainty.
And to that point, what type of response do you get then, for example, from Representative Walz to a possibility
support
of this?
Okay, support, Mr. Chair. Absolutely support.
Thank you. Next on the list is Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for coming to put this presentation together. I look forward to our discussions, especially as we get a little deeper into some of the numbers at another meeting. I just had a few quick questions. The first one, I want to go to page 3 of your handout here that references your slides. You have in the green wedge, it says other revenue, 14%, as pertaining to where your money comes from. Could you tell me where that, what that other, would you define other for me? Is, I'm looking at this and I'm assuming that the vast majority of other would be in fines or penalty fees. Would you enlighten me on that?
I can speak to the penalties, Mr. Chair, and then my Chief Financial Officer Joshua Bunker will answer the sources that go into that other revenue category. Our penalties are deposited directly into the fund, to the environmental fund. So when a company is penalized for violating any of the permit provisions or failing to have a permit, the penalties are paid directly into the environmental fund. They do not return to the agency until they're appropriated by a future legislature and governor's action. The actual amount of penalties relative to our overall budget is less than 1% of our overall budget. We've calculated it out. It averages somewhere between $1.5 million a year to $2.5 million, I think, was the largest amount we received in any given year. So if you just take the long-term average, I think we've calculated it's 0.8% of our total budget that comes in penalties and those related fines. I would ask my CFO, Joshua Bunker, to answer your question about all the sources in that other revenue.
Mr. Bunker.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Joshua Bunker.
Hold that microphone over there.
My name is Joshua Bunker. I'm the Chief Financial Officer. To the question of other sources within the other revenue, we have really four pots of money that make up those dollars. A very small amount, a state government special revenue that comes from wastewater operator training. We have an amount of clean water revolving funds that actually support our engineering work on wastewater treatment. Engineering review that is connected with the PFA public facilities. We have some restricted, the financial category is restricted, miscellaneous special revenue that has to do with agreements that we have for doing things like expedited permitting with outside parties. And then the other largest category within that, just under $55 million, so by far the largest chunk, are pieces that are used for our cost allocation plan. And so that is not actually revenue coming from outside, but because of the way our financial system is set up, those are billings within the agency itself to support internal operations.
Representative Newberger.
Could you put that into English? I'm not a CFO. I'm just an ambulance driver. When you talk about cost allocation plans and billing, internal billing structures, would you kind of put that into a more bite-sized pieces?
Sure.
Commissioner Stein.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Newberger. I'll take a shot at that because I also am not a CFO. So what we do on every dollar that comes into the agency, we have an indirect charge, it's called, to pay for the rent of our facilities, the heat and the lights in our facilities, the phone systems in our facilities, the vehicles that we operate, all those things that most businesses would categorize as operational costs. We get from all our revenue sources, and but for the ones that Joshua mentioned that are other sources, that indirect charge is really your internal operating costs. And you allocate those costs across your business units, just like a business does. So a business would charge their business units to have their human resources function, to have some of their needs for, as I said, all of our facilities and all of our other equipment. So that's maybe helpful.
Right here.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I appreciate that. I just wanted to follow up with two things here. Number one, I'm looking at the slide of the little kid at the beach. I appreciate you putting that up there. Last summer, my wife and I were at a public beach in our great state. Try not to bring up the mental image of me in a swimming suit because I wouldn't want to go there. Yeah. We went. Yeah, don't poke out your mind's eye. So point being is that we were there at around 11 o'clock in the morning during the week. It was a low turnout kind of a day, which is why I selected that day. But when we arrived at the beach, there was literally one 8-inch path for the entire beach that you could kind of, it was like walking through a minefield. I think you know where I'm going with this. The goose manure was embarrassing, and that's what that beach looked like. And it's not just the one lake that we are at. This is a problem. We have this, what I call an invasive species, these Canadian geese. And the hard part was, after once you got into the water and it looked like that, Since you got into the water, you would swim out about 10 feet, and then you kind of got out of the poop zone, and then you felt okay to swim in it. Once we got done, and I walked my little path through the minefield back to my car, and we were getting changed, and we had set up some lawn chairs. We were just going to try to enjoy the day. A big recreational vehicle pulled up, and it was a family. They were from Michigan, and this was their very first visit to Minnesota. And they had about 8 kids, at least that I could count. And these kids, being kids, had their towels, their rubber ducks, and their beach balls, and they went flying down to the beach like kids do. And they got to that first level of sand, and it was just, they all just stopped. Mm-hmm. Except for this one 2-year-old. He didn't know what he was running through. He didn't care. He just went. Yeah. So these kids all stood there, and the older kids. And it was, to say it was disgusting would not be doing it justice. At that time, the parents finally caught up with the kids, and they were all just standing there. This was their very first day, their very first visit ever to the land of 10,000 lakes. And I felt very embarrassed, mm-hmm, that this was their first experience with our water. And I had to kind of show the kids how to get through the minefield so they get down to the water and enjoy their time. I've been on this committee now, this is my 3rd year on this committee, and I've yet to hear really the goose issue, the invasive goose issue addressed. And I would like to have the agency respond to the... I have not heard any impact on what these things are doing to our water quality as well. I hear a lot of the impact on what agriculture, mm-hmm, and other sources is doing. But I'm telling you, these geese are out of control, and that is an issue that we have to shine some light on. I just wanted to bring that to your attention. And then finally, final point, Mr. Chair, if I may.
You may.
I thought it was really good that you brought up the point, you know, where does it go when you flush the toilet? It goes away. Where does it go when you throw out the garbage? It goes away. One of your slides up there was a very ominous photograph of Beijing. The air over China, if you look at there's two primary jet streams, as we know, there's the polar and the subtropical. Both of those, the air over China goes away. A couple of days later, away is right here. So the air over Beijing is the air over Minnesota. So when we talk about, and as we move forward in this committee, and we talk about air quality in Minnesota, there is an enormous percentage that is completely out of our control. And I just wanted to make sure we have established that as we move forward in this committee and as we start having environmental air quality conversations and how we're going to handle that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Representative Neuberger. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, and Representative Neuberger, I really appreciate those examples because they are actually, we think about many of the same things. Our staff, when we do watershed monitoring, we look specifically at what share of the nutrients in our waters are coming from natural sources. And geese, I was around when we first had a Canada goose. By the way, if you say Canadian geese to the people who live north of the border, they get upset by that. Just they're actually Canada geese. They get upset. The Canadians actually don't like that they're referred to as Canadian geese, but that's another story. Those geese and the natural production of nutrients, which is waste from all our critters, are in our waters too. So our staff do characterize that natural contribution to water quality problems. And we will give answers. We're happy to give you answers about that. If we want to talk about that specifically, I think we should do that because it would be helpful for us to have that story told again and again, because I agree that it is a problem that needs attention. Addressing invasive species as well as the natural population. Secondly, on air quality, you're absolutely right. We do enjoy the benefits of the polar jet stream and the harm of the polar jet. It gets cold, but one of the benefits of the polar jet stream is it cleans out our air. We get that blast from the north all year long when the jet stream adjusts, and being on the edge of the prairie, we have some significant advantages because of that statewide. Now, in the metropolitan area and specific places around the state where we have hills and valleys and we have concentrated populations, it's a little different story, and we are eager to talk to you about that as well.
Thank you. Just for a note, we don't have any of that in my district, the hills and valleys and concentrated populations. So, Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for coming today. The question on regulatory certainty, you said you collaborate with EPA, several states in the area. My question is, do you collaborate with foreign entities too? And the reason I'm going here is several projects in northern Minnesota either sit on the Lake Superior watershed or the Rainy watershed. And there are currently about 42 similar operations that are in the Canadian side of the Lake Superior and or Rainy watershed. And the ones that we have in northern Minnesota are facing a lot of opposition. So I would like to know how you collaborate with the Canadian government on these same type projects to see what they're doing.
Mr. Stein.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. McGregor. I do, and our agency does, work with our Canadian counterparts, specifically on the Great Lakes. I am a member of the Great Lakes Executive Committee, which is responsible for implementing the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement, which was signed by the Premier of Canada and President Nixon originally. It has been updated and reaffirmed several times since that agreement was signed. The purpose of that agreement is to systematically work across provincial and state lines and national boundaries to improve and restore water quality in the Great Lakes. The Great Lakes is the largest freshwater resource in the world. It is also the fifth largest economy in the world. If you took the Great Lakes as an economic area of its own, just the basin and so it's a huge asset, natural asset, and an economic engine. And so protecting the water quality of the Great Lakes is something that we take very seriously. We work with our partners, and our job in trying to restore water quality is limited to what we can do in Minnesota. And so our work in the St. Louis River, our work on the Poplar River up near Lutzen, we have had great cooperation in making sure that we protect and restore water quality, and we communicate that with our Canadian partners. Now let's go to the Rainy and the other parts of your district, I know, and the northern Minnesota. We have completed our work on the Rainy River monitoring and load assessment. We've provided that to the International Joint Commission that has a working group trying to address water quality in Lake of the Woods and on the Rainy itself. Our goal is much more advanced because of the data and the scientific work that we have than the Canadians have met. So we're working through our members on the IJC, which is a federally sponsored, the Canadian government, the U.S. government appoint people to the International Joint Commission. We're working with them to try to develop a meaningful plan for restoration of water quality on the Rainy and on Lake of the Woods. I would say this. We advocate for parity and equitable allocation of solutions rather than just because we have more knowledge of where the problems are coming from. We shouldn't be the ones driving the solution. The Canadians need to match that. I would say on the Rainy and on Lake of the Woods, there's more work to be done. We're not where we'd like to be with the Canadians on that. I met with the General Counsel of the Canadian Embassy, who's here in Minneapolis, just last week, and I brought this to his attention. I said, I hope we can work together on that.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there's a little misconception on the Rainy watershed. It doesn't start right around International Falls. It's somewhere around the Pigeon River.
Yep.
And flows that direction west and north. So my point is there's quite a few projects in there that don't seem to get the scrutiny that we do here, and I was just curious about how you deal with that with the Canadian government. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Eklund, I'd like to talk to you about those projects, and maybe we can have a one-on-one conversation about that so I can be better informed about your concerns.
Thank you. Well, I could take it one step further. The conversation that I would like to have, too, at some point is, you know, the permitting and so forth that they go through, and how do we get projects, the New Gold Mine, for example, the Rainy River Project with the New Gold Company, just east and north of Bedette and north of Emo, Canada, Ontario. I think Representative Eklund was referring in Ontario to 40-plus mines that are currently functioning. And we'd like to take, I'd like to take a look at, you know, what do they go through for a permitting process? What do we go through? What are the timelines? And what is the end product? Okay. Next on the list is Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the Commissioner. Thanks for coming today. You had mentioned that the EPA can overrule any permit issued by the MPCA, and I was just wondering how often that happens and under what circumstances that would happen.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sundin, it's not frequent. I can say in my term there's only been three, maybe four permits that the EPA has expressed an objection to. In order for them to do so, they have to insert their voice at a time within a certain period of time once after issuing a permit or our intention to issue a permit is noticed. They have a specific period of time in which they have to object. So of the thousands and thousands of permits that we've issued, very few have been met with objection by the EPA. The reason that I believe that's the case, let me just say, is because, as I mentioned earlier, our scientific understanding of our water resources and our air quality and our solid waste and toxic materials is, I don't want to come across as bragging on what we've accomplished, but our agency has done an enormous amount of work to gather the right data to answer every question that people might have about impacts. And so we've done a tremendous amount of work to gather scientific information and present that in a way that's understandable for people. So we rarely hear a scientific objection from EPA. Sometimes we get objections over what assumptions we may have made on a specific permit, or we have had some concerns occasionally over tribal government objections because the tribal government's relationship with the federal government is different than the tribal government's relationship with the state government. And so we have had a permit or two where tribal governments have asked EPA to insert their voice. In every circumstance, though, we have met those their concerns and objections, and those permits have moved forward. We are not I don't want to say that we have a strained relationship with the EPA. We have a healthy, tense relationship with the EPA. We do not think that our work fails to meet the requirements of any of the federal laws. When they object, we listen carefully, like I have listened to many of you, about objections and concerns about our work. And we work to understand those concerns and then address them. And in every permit where the EPA has objected, to my knowledge, they've withdrawn their objection. Or we have helped them to withdraw by adjusting some detail in a permit. But I would say that's the nature of our relationship with EPA on permitting.
Follow-up, Representative Sundin?
Good, thank you.
Okay. Healthy, tense relationship. Was that what you said?
That's exactly what I said.
And you looked right at me, Commissioner. I'm not sure what you're I'm kidding.
I enjoy several healthy, tense relationships. One is back at home, actually.
Okay, we'll work through the chair here. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome, Commissioner. I appreciated your explanation of a permit as being an agreement. I don't think we've talked about that in that way before. And with an agreement, you've got both sides working together and essentially shaking hands and their word, making that agreement. And the agreement has a purpose, and that purpose is to protect our air, our water, our land. So I think that's a good way of describing it, because a permit, you know, permit you can take in many different ways. If you look it up in the dictionary, it's to allow something. Mm-hmm. I think that's how often we think of it. But if to think of it as an agreement, I think is a better understanding for Minnesotans. I also appreciate, you know, I've been here for a while now, and it seems like every year we hear the agency is using fines to pad their budget. And I think truth-telling that 0.08% of the budget coming from fines, let me just repeat that, 0.08% of the budget coming from fines is not padding the budget or going after people to enhance your employees.
Representative, Mr. Chair, yes. Representative Hansen, the one thing about permits, I know some of you have worked in local government or have more experience in county or city government. Our permits run with the property. They are an agreement. They're kind of like a conditional use permit, but they have a longer term. They're 5 years, generally. Some, for feedlots, are 10-year permits. So the term of our permit is really to provide the kind of operating boundaries for a facility or for someone who holds that permit to conduct their work. There are specific parameters, but they're not, we do not, I would also say that we do not specify methods or requirements for how people meet those required discharge parameters. So we work with them. It is more like an agreement. The engineers, for example, of an industrial facility, we say for the air emissions from your stack, what kind of equipment are you using? What's your opportunity to reduce pollution and air emissions? We often can help them identify a more effective way to reduce air emissions with different technology or with different equipment or with different combinations. So we work together, it's true, and we are criticized by many environmental organizations for having a close working relationship with businesses because we work with them to try to optimize the benefits of the environment for the health of our people. But because of that, we have to work with people. And one of the concerns that I hear from environmental organizations and people around the state is those folks get to talk to you every day at will because they're subject to your permit requirements and you're duty-bound to talk to them. What about us? What about the rest of the people? That is why we have public comment periods on all of our permits. You might know that I have worked in different agencies, and other agencies don't have as much transparency about their permitting process as we are obligated to have under the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. Now, some people think that's time-consuming and painful. It is if you're trying to get approved. But I will also say that the transparency that it provides to the community is a tremendous asset in the deliberation before making decisions. I have a group of people right now that are upset with me because I'm considering a hog farm in Goodhue County. The owners are upset with me. They want to get their hog barn built. It's going to be 4,600 hogs near Zumbrota. The neighbors are upset with me. They think that we've been deaf and dumb to their concerns over environmental impacts, odors, water quality. Now, I will say that my job, the job of my staff, is to stay dispassionately objective to the requirements for air and water quality and land quality and listen to everybody and then make a decision in a timely fashion. 97% of the permits that we issue meet the goals for timeliness that the legislature and the governor agreed on. 97%. And 96% of all permitted facilities in this state meet every one of their permitting requirements. We have a high compliance rate. We have a high timeliness achievement. So I know that people are concerned about this, and they're concerned about our effective work, but I just need to tell you, from my perspective, we work hard, and the staff that are with me today can tell you just how hard they work to listen and do their job effectively and make decisions. Thank you for indulging me, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
And follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Commissioner and Mr. Chair. And I was going to actually ask a different question that you interrupted me on. But, you know, we're talking about the federal government and permitting, and the world's going to change in about a week here. We have a new administration coming in, and depending on your perspective, that may be a great change, or maybe it's not a great change. But I think we could agree that it's going to be different. And if we take people at their word, that may mean substantial changes in terms of funding the EPA, or I think whether it's eliminated, whether it's changed. So again, after a few years hearing about how the big bad EPA is going to force us to do something, what happens if it's not there, either de facto not there or functionally not there, where its job is to just rubber stamp things? And then what happens to the states? What happens to this idea, or it's the federal government that made us do it? Or I think in the past, Minnesota's wanted to be stronger than the federal government, or stronger than the standards of, let's say, other states.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, a couple thoughts on that. A significant concern is the lack of funding. We operate some of our programs with federal funds. All states do. States that join. I'm currently the president of the national organization of my colleagues, my peers. It's called the Environmental Council of the States. Every state commissioner or secretary or director, whatever position that is in their respective state, work together to lobby and advocate within the federal government for effective work. Our primary objective is to assure that EPA and the states have a constructive regulatory working relationship. We are very concerned about the lack of funding that could impact on states' abilities to keep a level playing field. Because here's what the federal law and the existence of EPA and all states that do this work create. They create a more effective level playing field for business and industry and communities around the country. Having that as sort of a leveling factor of EPA working across the country to oversee the work of states is extremely helpful. Businesses tell us all the time that they don't want to face wildly different standards from one place to another. That's one of the benefits of having consistency across the nation. It's a risk if we were to lose that. It's unclear, as you've said, what EPA will be in the future. One of the things that we depend on EPA to do is to work on advancing the science of water quality standards, air standards, and without that, states would be left to their own to come up with these kinds of scientific decisions about what's protective of health and the environment. That would be a significant burden on any state to carry on its own, and one of the benefits that EPA provides is that consistent format and framework for developing those standards. We hope that in working with the new administration that they'll understand these values and would consider it strongly before they make further statements or decisions about the future of the EPA.
Follow up? Commissioner, just a quick follow up for myself. And you know, you said that the EPA creates a level playing field from state to state. And I think that in the conversations that I have with people, they don't feel that it is necessary level. And not so much in terms of the quality of the or the rigors of the standards, but it's just more the timeliness, the cost, and all that sort of things that are associated with the permits. Mm-hmm. In committee yesterday, our Jobs and Energy Committee, Representative Baker was talking to Commissioner Hardy over at Deed, and he asked her, and I'm sure maybe you had some staff there, I don't know, but he asked her to sit down with you to try to create a climate in your agency that was as favorable for business as what he perceived it to be in over at Deed. And he said, and I'm paraphrasing, that businesses are really hamstrung by MPCA at times. And when you talk about partnering and an agreement, I think that oftentimes cities and counties and businesses feel like, well, we have to make this agreement because, you know, MPCA has all the power. And, we've had this discussion before in our healthy, tense relationship. So just wanted to point it out that it's not just me. Thank you. So next on the list is Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Stein, nice to see you. I'm so glad that we're talking about permits because I'm probably sitting around a table here. I'm probably the only person that has held MPCA permits in my former paint company, Hirschfield Paint Manufacturing in Minneapolis. not only did we have MPCA permits, but EPA permits, Hennepin County permits, and about a dozen other permits. And I got to tell you, it's not a big kumbaya thing, all right? It's very, for businesses, it's very expensive, very time-consuming, and very frustrating to deal with the permitting process. I had a gentleman, a chemist on my staff, that did that full-time. The reporting requirements and everything else are an extreme burden on industry and very expensive. And going through the permitting process can take a very, very long time. Too long. To paint this as a situation where everybody's working together, I think everybody tries to work together. But with any kind of bureaucracy, it's very difficult. And I have a couple questions for you, both with regard to permitting and some other things. Right now, what would you say your average permitting time is from start to finish? And secondly, what are you doing to reduce those times for businesses?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglemont, we've got two categories of permits that we measure under the statutory requirements for timeliness. We have one category that is a 90 days or less, and I believe I don't have the detail on the average time on that category of permits. We have also a 150-day requirement in the statute for more complicated types of permits. The best answer I can give you without, you know, trying to average everything, because there can be a couple of permits that take inordinately longer because of the complexity. So all I could go back to is about 96% of all permits go out the door in accordance with that timeline. We can get you more details on specific categories of permits if that would help, if there's something. But on average, I don't have that data right now, but I'll get it for you and provide that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, Representative Uglem. And if I could interject for just a second, too, and folks, I think most of you realize, too, that most of those permits in that 97% efficiency, you might say, those are stormwater permits, and those are relatively simple.
Correct. In the 90-day goal, that's correct. There's a significant number that are just very short transactions because of online business practices.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Stein, well, I know you have your continuous improvement process over there, based on that, what are you doing to reduce even this rate that you have now?
Commissioner.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Uglem, we've identified a number of steps to make our permitting and our reporting requirements, which is part of permitting, because when you have the agreement, part of the agreement is to report, as you know. We've been migrating all of those decisions all of our processes have been reviewed and scrutinized for timeliness. We continue to do that on an ongoing basis, but we are upgrading our systems to allow for more online services with our customers. So we are about a quarter of the way through transforming all of our systems so that they can all occur online. So submittals can be made online, reports can be submitted online, wastewater treatment plant operators now submit all of their monitoring data to us online, so their laboratory data that they collect and analyze can just be loaded directly into our system, so there's not a significant burden there. And we're doing similar work to upgrade and streamline our systems across all of our other regulatory approaches. We could spend a long time talking about this, and I'd be happy to do that if you want to get into our continuous improvement projects and our review of our own excellence as an agency that we've been working on.
Okay. Representative Uglem, follow up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm sure some of our rural representation here might have some questions about ag and permitting and things like that. I wanted to also ask you a little bit about renewal of permits, because I have a constituent in Champlin, First Minnesota Bank, who during the recession acquired a housing project that has a communal sewer system in Walker, Minnesota, up there in Representative Bliss's district. I was just in the other day, and the vice president there has told me that it's taken over a year, and he still has no action on a renewal of a permit that he submitted all the paperwork for, and all he does is get the runaround. Now, I'm very concerned about that. And when we talk about permitting, this is a perfect example of what's going on with many businesses around the state. I'm just wondering if you have any knowledge of the backlog of some of these renewals and permits.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Uglin, let me just a little bit on that, and then I think we should talk to you about that. I don't know that specific case, but I appreciate very specific examples like that because of what it can do to help focus our work on what the priorities are. And that's what I wanted to talk about. When we get when a facility has a permit from us, and let's say they're coming up on renewal, and so they've had a five-year permit, and they're required before the expiration of that five-year permit to submit their request for renewal.
Which you did.
They are in compliance by virtue of having submitted their request. The renewal then gets placed in a queue for prioritization by our staff based on if it's a need to expand a business or to, let's say they're trying to sell the property. For example, if the bank holds the title to that entire development in that facility, they may be trying to sell that. And having the permit renewed then would become a higher priority for us. So I would say that renewals are always a challenge because of the work that's required to get them all renewed. We prioritize them based on the desire to move something forward, either expand a business or update equipment or meet a financing need or requirement that they're obliged to meet. Jeff Smith from my industrial division has long-standing history with making these priority decisions, and that's why we need to know if there's a priority need that's coming up. Now, I would like to talk about that specific situation.
I would
love to be able to say to everybody who submitted their renewal that we're going to get to it in X number of days. If I were to have to put a cost to that, I would be dramatically increasing the need for staff in our agency to upgrade permits. We have the same number of staff now than we had 6 years ago. We have 900 people in our agency. We move them around to meet the highest priority needs. And we actually, I know the history of the agency was to have some more staff maybe to meet that need. As you heard my CFO mention, sometimes we work with a facility that needs expedited processing. They're willing to pay for some overtime. That has helped some of our folks. But those are Band-Aid solutions, Mr. Chair and Representative Uglin. And so we have to prioritize our work. That's the way we do it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Uglin.
Thank you. Well, hopefully you can call Chuck over there at First Minnesota Bank.
I'm happy to do that, Representative.
All right. I have another question on a different subject. And this is with regard to clean water. In the bonding bill, which Representative Torkelson and I worked on last year, we had lots of money in that bonding bill for rural sewage treatment plants, water treatment plants, and everything else. And yet, of course, that bill was not acted on at the very last minute of the session. I regarded that as a horrible thing in legislative process. But now the governor has submitted his new bonding bill, and what is I haven't had a chance to review everything. What is the agency's position on some of these projects, and are we going to be able to get this done?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Uglin, the governor's bonding bill this year is the same number for wastewater treatment facilities as it was last year, $167 million. We support those projects. They support wastewater treatment and drinking water systems. And we use those dollars, as you may know, with assistance from the Public Facilities Authority to leverage federal dollars that we get for those construction and upgrade grants. And then the governor also supported last year in policy changes that would extend the amount of money that's provided in a grant versus a loan because of the problem that municipal governments are facing in debt service, as well as eligibility requirements were extended so that more communities would meet the eligibility requirements. So the governor has strong support. We are strong supporters of that investment. We have an $11 billion need over the next 20 years for water infrastructure in this state alone. Four of that are for wastewater treatment facilities. Seven are for drinking water facilities. Drinking water is the health department's business. Ours is the wastewater side. And we have a long habit and practice of leveraging as much federal money as we can. And Director Freeman, Jeff Freeman of the Public Facilities Authority, does a phenomenal job. We are completely supportive of that package. I, too, look back on that legislative session and say it was a significant missed opportunity. Now the my job's not your job, so I better stop talking now.
Thank you.
All right, here. Thank you. Thank you so much for your answers, though. They were very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question relates a little to Representative Uglin's second question. We're tracking as usual, Representative Uglin. And I've been thinking a lot about this situation we had over the summer in Flint, Michigan, which, you know, there's a lot of causes of that problem. We need to upgrade infrastructure, but we also have to have proper oversight and enforcement of permits and regulations, which didn't happen in that situation. And, it's mind-boggling to me that in the 21st century in the United States of America, an entire city has to go have bottled water and the kids are exposed to lead. And, a long history of lack of oversight and regulation that caused that. So I hope that one of our goals is to make sure that never happens anywhere in the country, but particularly in Minnesota. And I understand that we have a situation, smaller scale, but still a situation in South Washington County, where families are having to use bottled water. And I guess I would be interested to know, what's the extent of that problem? What are the causes, and what are you able to do about that?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, South Washington County's groundwater has been contaminated with perfluorinated compounds as a result of the lawful discharge of waste products from 3M Company from 1940 until 1978. They disposed of wastes from their Cottage Grove facility, where they were developing and manufacturing compounds that go into Scotchgard, if you want. And then DuPont purchased those products from them and the patent for the development of those compounds to make their Teflon. So, again, I only bring that up because that period of time is an example of what people did before there was an awareness of the impact of their actions on the environment and on health. Now, recently, the EPA updated their water quality standards for perfluorinated compounds in groundwater. That meant that they lowered the bar for water quality to protect health. We have this legacy pollution site in South Washington County ranging from Lake Elmo and Oakdale all the way down to Hastings, where the groundwater is contaminated, and we are systematically going back house by house on private wells to evaluate whether or not their drinking water is at or below that federal limit. Because what we're learning, there are about 160 homes that are now being served with bottled water until they can get a more permanent solution. When I was at the health department in the mid-2000s, this situation unfolded. There were hundreds of homes that needed to be upgraded. The agency and the health department worked together to primarily assure that people have safe drinking water, that they're not exposed to anything of risk and their family is safe. And that's where I live, by the way. I lived in Oakdale, and my water and my family drank that water for 20 years. So it's not just a professional interest of mine. It's a personal one. But I also would say that the work we're doing on these old legacy contaminated sites is some of the most specific needs that communities face. We've got dry cleaners all over the state that for decades took dry cleaning fluid out into the back of their building and dumped it on the ground. It was the normal thing everyone did. It left a plume of groundwater contamination in almost every community around the state that had a dry clean. And we are now going back and remedying all of those places where the plume of those compounds are moving through the soil into the basements of those homes. It's an enormous task that we face.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
So thank you, Mr. I have a quick follow-up then related to that, and thank you for your answer. My understanding is that now we've had, there's 10 new Superfund sites that have been uncovered. And, you know, again, we just have this toxic legacy of what, you know, happened in the past before we had regulation, before we had oversight, before we had agencies like yours that are, you know, trying to prevent pollution. So 10 new sites. What's the plan for that? And is there ongoing contamination and air vapors and things like that that we should be concerned about? And where are those sites,
Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein. Vapors are a concern at every one of those 10 additional sites. Soil vapors, because what we've come to learn, and this is really more recent, we were early on most concerned with groundwater contamination. If anyone's well was using that water, it would pump it out for drinking water. That's still our primary concern. Now, if that's not a concern, those volatile organic compounds like dry cleaning fluids and other things of that nature can migrate up through the soil. They vaporize and move through the soil and get into basements. Vapors are a concern at every one of those sites, and we've got about 1,400 sites in the state that we're systematically evaluating now to look for the risk and identify where we need to take more action. Some of those sites, and Greta Gauthier, my legislative director, can show you on a map where they are all across the state. They're everywhere. In many places, and it's just the work that we do to prioritize and assess. But we have needs to do more work in those areas.
So, Mr. Chair, I guess that if the agency could provide the committee with that map, I think that might be very helpful.
We're happy to do so. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep. I've got five people on the list here yet. So, Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner and team, for the hearing this morning. Two areas I want to question about. One is we've talked about recommendations and input and transactions with federal legislators, EPA. What we haven't talked about is transactions with U.S. Department of Agriculture and Department of Interior relative to the denial of some mineral exploration leases up in Representative Eklund's area in the Rainy Lake watershed. So could you tell us what your recommendations were, if any, specific to the U.S. Forest Service and BLM? And just so we understand, the denial of renewal of those permits severely impacts the ability to gather resources off in school trust land that are currently under lease that belong to the schools here in Minnesota.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lewick, I had no recommendation, nor was I asked.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Thank you. I wish you'd maybe been asked, because we obviously have not done an environmental review, so it's kind of hard to make decisions without looking at data first, but I appreciate that answer. Second one is, and this is kind of an open-ended question, we exchanged correspondence over Sandpiper and potential for employees getting pretty active beyond the scope of their job description. That's history. Dead horse, that one's gone. But we're now beginning the process of permitting Line 3, which is a replacement of a 50-year-old line that needs to be replaced. And so I would simply ask that we make sure that, and this goes for DNR and MPCA employees, that they clearly stay in their lanes, because you're stuck when you show up as an employee of MPCA. People recognize that, and they make the assumption that you're an expert. And there's a line between providing expert when they speak for you and they speak as a citizen. I would just ask that we make sure that we none of our state employees even get close to that line of speaking for you as the NPCA commissioner as policy as opposed to speaking individually as a citizen. Because line three is a big deal. If we don't replace that, I mean, we are frankly felony stupid because we've got a line that's old and we've got new technology that can make it safer. So we can't be tarrying on that. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lewick, thank you. And I respect entirely your desire to make sure that our employees follow the code of ethics. Because you're absolutely right. There are actual conflicts of interest that can occur and potential perceived conflicts of interest. We do a lot to try to educate, inform our employees of their duty under the law. And I respect that we're not going to talk about last year. Going forward on line three, as you know, the Public Utilities Commission is responsible for the process of evaluating and approving any pipeline. We at the agency and the Department of Natural Resources are supporting and assisting the Department of Commerce or the lead staff to develop the environmental information for the Line 3 replacement. According to my knowledge, and my Deputy Commissioner Michelle Beeman works on that project every week to review the schedule for timeliness, and we are following a very tight timeline, and we are committed to meeting the timeliness goals for getting that decision made.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Metzel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I just wanted to take a moment. I had a few other things on my list, but I know we're running out of time and there's a few people left, so I'll save them for a different meeting. I'm sure I'll get to see you a lot in this committee.
Sure.
I did want to give thanks, though. I know last year we went round and round on a bill to put the new formula for the sulfate standard in the KETAC permit. And in talking with Larry Sutherland, when I got the call notifying me that they're, half of their employees anyway right now would be going back to work, about 200 folks, he assured me that the work that we did on that bill would likely not have been opening with the 10 standard in there. And so I think there's always room to compromise, and I know that those families and my community, or our communities, I should say, really appreciate your flexibility last year. And, Mr. Chair, I know you helped with that, so it took the village, and just wanted to give thanks to those 200 folks going back to work right now.
Thanks. Commissioner Stein? Okay. Anything else, Representative Metza?
Nope, that's it, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fisher?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for being here today. One of the areas I've got a question is how people are being engaged where we've got communities of color, poor areas, where they've traditionally been cut out of the process. And these are usually areas, and where I'm thinking, one that leaps to mind real quick is what's happened over in North Minneapolis, where you have higher incidence of children with lead in their bodies, higher incidence of asthma, which leads to them not being performed well in school, which leads to them being trapped in a poverty cycle because they can't get the skills to get broken out. These are also the communities that don't have the capacity and time to always get engaged in the process to be able to provide input. What are some of the things that your agency is trying to do to try to address some of the disparities that have crept into our system?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Fisher. Two things on the Northern Metals issue directly. We have a direct and close working relationship with neighborhood and community members. So our staff work with the community members to address their interests and concerns, provide them with real time information. It was largely their reports of something going on at Northern Metals that led us to get more information from the company about that. Ultimately, has been proven, in our view, to show increased levels of pollution from that facility. We're working with them, and we're eager to have a solution. Secondly, we have, because of what I mentioned earlier, of making sure that everyone's voice is heard, not just the parties that are regulated, not just the governments that have staff that can contribute, but people who live in communities. And the underrepresented voices in our conversations are often those that you mentioned, people of color, people of low income status. We formed an environmental justice advisory group of 15 members who represent those communities of color and low income around the state. They are helping us to develop more systematic approaches that we can use in every permit and every action we take to make sure we are including community voices, representative community voices. It's just forming. It's beginning its work. I met with them last week. We had a great conversation about how to improve our public meetings, for example, how to improve our communications with people that don't have English as their first language, how to improve our outreach to make sure we connect with people who might have an interest in the facility in their neighborhood. So we're beginning that process, and it's going very well at this point.
Representative Fisher, follow-up? Yes, one quick follow-up, but not on this one. It's just one that came off of Representative Hornstein, is on the PCF issue in the Washington County area. Am I correct that you folks are currently in some areas using wells to try to control the spread of the plume of the PCFs down there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, yes, that's correct. Certainly on the site that was the historic disposal site for 3M's waste at the top of the hill in Cottage Grove, that's where the material was disposed. The perimeter of that site is surrounded by wells that the goal of those wells is to pump the water and keep it back on the property rather than letting it discharge down gradient, meaning going down slope. And so, yes, that's part of our remediation plan. We also have that same solution going on at almost every closed landfill around the state, because the waste in those landfills can be managed best by keeping the groundwater in the footprint. But we will be managing those landfills forever. So when we talk about closed landfills, the cost of remedying that problem, which has been enormously helpful to communities all over the state, is a forever problem.
Just one final quick comment. The reason I kind of brought this up is that part of the metropolitan area is an area where the aquifer is dropping rapidly. The amount of water that is pumped out to control this is almost half or a little over half of all the water pumped out in that area, and that's one of the things contributing to the continued decline. And this is one of the things that when we have legacy things like this occur, it not only causes problems right there, but long-term problems in the future, and they're going to have to find new sources of water for that area, probably eventually the Mississippi, which will cost hundreds of millions of dollars for those communities to build those kind of plants. And I know it's a tense relationship sometimes between businesses and the regulations, but this is the consequences when, you know, back then it was fine to do these type of things, but these are the consequences and the things that are going to cost us large dollar amounts in the future.
Thank you.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being with us, Commissioner. I'd like to circle back to permitting just for a moment. The issue of incomplete permits, can you describe how that works with your timing and just if you've got any statistics on how many incomplete permits you deal with?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, thank you for that question. That is a part of our timeliness goal, is to assure that permits that come in the door get an answer within 30 days. So if an application is made, we have a 30-day window in which we try to We have been 100% responding to every applicant, whether their permit is complete within that 30-day window. It is, I'm just checking, about 20% of the permits that we receive are incomplete in that 30-day window.
President Torkelson, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then, so a permit gets sent back, so to speak, to the permit requester, and they try again. And how many of those cycle through that system more than once?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I think it would be more true that we would notify the applicant to submit the missing information and don't try again. I mean, part of our responsibility is not to overcomplicate the process. This was part of my argument with folks on this hog barn that I talked about earlier. There are people who think we should start the process all over again. And my answer is, we all know what we know. They gave me a lot of information. Now they gave me more information. We all know that. So that's the same thing we should do with a business owner or a permit applicant. If they gave us 80% or 90% of what we needed, we only need 10% more, let's get that 10% and call it done. That's the way we approach it. I think it's very common sense. I have not heard of a permit applicant that was so recalcitrant as to say, I'm just not going to do this then. You'll have to send it all back to me. And we, as you know, it's our responsibility to be as effective as we can. We frustrate some people, I know, but we also, by getting the right information up front, we can do our job more effectively making the decision. So I'm committed to that, as you know, Representative and Mr. Chair, that I want our processes to be efficient.
Thank you. Representative Sparkles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I thank you for that answer, and it's just there are some people that have the impression that the goalpost keeps moving as they're trying to get a permit, and we want to avoid that. Another quick issue I'd like you to talk about briefly is the St. Louis Estuary project that was also part of a bonding bill that did not get signed into law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Torkelson, the St. Louis River proposal last year was in the governor's bonding bill, and the request that came before both bodies in the legislature for $12.7 million in state match to go up against federal dollars that were available through the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. One of the few things that Congress has agreed on financially over the past 5 years is spending money to restore and improve the Great Lakes. This year's bonding bill has been increased in the ask in the governor's request from $12.7 million to $25.4 million. That would complete the work that was anticipated by the availability of the federal funds. It will go to work. There are about 15 sites on the estuary where work is needed to remedy contaminated sediments and to do water quality improvement work. And that's the status of that ask in the governor's bonding bill. What's critical about that is the availability of the federal funds. The federal funds will, the state funding at $25.4 million will leverage $45 million in federal funds and really advance the work. We have a strong partnership up there with the business community, with the folks in the non-governmental organizations and the local governments, and I'm very hopeful, Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, as you know, as in your role on the bonding committee, and as well as being a representative to the Great Lakes Commission, that we can get that site restored.
Follow up? Representative Wagenius. We have four people on the list yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you've told us a lot about the legacy of the PFO and the cost to citizens and the cost to the state. It seems to me history is getting ready to repeat itself with endocrine disruptors. Scientists are now telling us that endocrine disruptors are harming the development of children. So what do you see as the implications of that for PCA?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, endocrine disrupting compounds, and you're quite knowledgeable about that, I know. The challenge that we have in our agency is there is not a technology available yet at an affordable cost to remove those compounds from our wastewater discharges. When we look downstream of any wastewater discharge, we will find those compounds in the water. That's the complication that I see, which is we can detect that there's a problem. You're right. There is evolving science that suggests that there's human health impacts, and there are certainly ecological impacts. Those have been documented, and the science community agrees that there's an ecological impact on fish and aquatic life from endocrine-disrupting compounds. So the challenge that we look at is how can we prevent those releases? Because if treatment is unavailable and unknowable, we should be preventing the discharge. We can only prevent the discharge by working upstream. Where are they coming from? They're coming from our byproducts in our human waste stream. They're coming from medicines that we use. They're coming from a variety of sources. So this is a challenging conversation. If you're going to solve one problem for the health and environmental benefits, you're going to be impacting other parts of our society. That's the nature of our business, of having uncomfortable conversations. We have a growing problem with chloride in our water systems as well, which comes in large part from our use of road salt in the metropolitan area.
Yes, Representative Wagenius.
If I could follow up.
You can.
We have acknowledged the problem and that wastewater treatment systems right now can't take it out. I think they do take out a percentage of it, but not all of it. So what are you specifically doing now on the prevention side?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I would say we are doing our best to educate wastewater operators and communities around the state about the nature of the problem. We also want to collect more data about those compounds and do more research and advocate for that with folks in the public health community. Specifically to reduce discharges, our job is to, first of all, pharmaceuticals as one potential source of compounds, working with the law enforcement community and local units of government to make sure that there are take-back programs and effective elimination of additional, of leftover pharmaceuticals. Right. And certainly that work is, you know, organizing collection of those compounds is one action we've taken, but there are many more that we could consider.
Representative Wagenius.
I think that would be helpful if you would let us know what are the sources of these compounds, that if they get into the wastewater, then they also get into our drinking water. And that's where I am very concerned.
Thank you.
Yep. Representative,
I do that, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, my question, which I realize will have to be a brief answer, was regarding the priority given to brownfield cleanup and redevelopment. And specifically, I'm thinking my district directly borders Arden Hills in the ammunition plant, which is now Rice Creek Commons, and that's something that folks in Ramsey County are really excited about. And so I'm just kind of curious about what the work that you're doing and maybe the priority given to those kinds of projects.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, we have a significant program on brownfield cleanup and restoration. We have restored thousands of acres of land to productive use around the state. Our job in that regard is to characterize contaminated soils and remedy them. We just and we work with the federal government because oftentimes, as you know, with TCAP, that's a federal Department of Justice or Department of the Army responsibility. And so we coordinate our work with the federal government, and we make sure that the soil conditions and the water conditions and any soil vapors and air pollution are remedied so that the intended use of the property meets public safety and public health requirements. It's a significant investment for us, and we are working all across the state in communities to remedy problems in those brownfield areas. We have a very successful tanks program that I would also mention in addition to our brownfields remediation. The tanks law that the legislature passed in this state decades ago now, has put Minnesota in a position that has resulted in the affordable cleanup of groundwater pollution from old gas stations and contaminated sites all across the state. We are farther ahead than every other state in the nation on that cleanup program, and we're very proud of it. And it has allowed for those properties to be turned over and put back into use, which is the goal, not about just the cleanup for cleanup's sake. It has to have a property value associated with it so it can be put back into productive use.
Representative Beckerpin, follow up. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the Commissioner. Just back to the permitting process, how many public meetings are generally held during that process? And when you have several players, like you mentioned, the Native tribes and other people, how many meetings are held and how are those structured?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sundin, it depends, I would say. But typically the minimum requirement is one if it's required to have some kind of a public information meeting. We often schedule more if it looks like there would be benefit for access to the information for the community members. Think of large projects. We tend to have more hearings for those kinds of projects where people are very engaged and interested, or where the project kind of evolves from its first concept to a, maybe it changes, we'll often add a second or a third public meeting to try to inform the public and all parties when the project evolves like that.
Thank you, Commissioner. Follow-up, Representative Sundin.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner and staff, for being here today. With that, we're